The Red Sox hunt for a new manager is in full swing. We'll tell you who some of the leading candidates are and a special report. The NCAA calls its college athletes amateurs, but are the schools getting rich off unpaid workers? We'll be joined by the team from the WBUR program, Only a Game. It's Thursday, October 19th, 2017. I'm Chris Gasper, and this is Season Ticket. Welcome to Season Ticket, a daily podcast from the Boston Globe Sports Department and WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. So, who would your pick be to be the next Red Sox manager? This is one of the toughest jobs in sports. Red Sox president of baseball operations, Dave Dombrowski, has said that there are veteran managers in baseball who have said they don't want to manage in Boston. The Red Sox got rid of manager John Farrell, even after winning a World Series in 2013, winning three American League East titles in five seasons, and leading the Red Sox to back-to-back American League East championships in 2016 and 2017. That's something no other Red Sox manager had ever done. There are a lot of names being tossed around for this job, so let's separate the contenders from the pretenders. To help us do that, we now bring in Boston Globe Red Sox beat reporter Peter Abraham. He joins us via Skype. Peter, welcome to Season Ticket.
Hey, Chris.
Obviously, you're following this managerial search, so let's just sort of go candidate by candidate. I think there are three main candidates that people have probably heard of: Alex Cora, Brad Ausmus, and Ron Gardenhire. We'll start with Alex Cora. He's currently the bench coach for the Houston Astros. He played for the Red Sox from 2005 to 2008. He was a member of the 2007 World Series Championship team. Now, he interviewed with Dave Dombrowski in New York. Break down Alex Cora for us and how likely he is to get this job.
Well, at the moment, Chris, I would say he's the odds-on favorite. He seems to be the candidate that every team that has a managerial vacancy wants to hire. But because of his connection to the Red Sox and because the Red Sox are essentially a win-now operation, he could come here and in his first year do something very special, much like John Farrell did and much like Terry Francona did. So I think Cora is the guy who they would like to hire, and for him it's probably the most attractive job. And what makes him such an appealing candidate are several things, really. His youth, he just turned 42 years old. The Red Sox feel like that would allow him to better connect to their younger players and be more of a motivational factor to them than John Farrell was. The other part of what people like about Alex Cora is he's a guy who's, even in his only 1 year as a major league coach, has been very influential in terms of adapting to the modern statistical analysis, the ability to use stats to prepare for games, things like that. And they believe Cora can come and maybe modernize the Red Sox approach a bit in terms of how those numbers are used.
Yeah, Cora would be my choice, Pete. I like him. I think he's a guy. He's still close to his playing career. He has some experience in the media. He was an analyst for ESPN, so he should be able to deal with the media in Boston, which is a big part of the job. When he was here as a player and throughout all his stops in baseball, he was a highly respected guy, just someone who could relate to everybody and sort of bridge the gap that might happen socially and culturally in a clubhouse in Major League Baseball. I think the only real question about him is that lack of managerial experience. Now, he's managed in, you know, like the Puerto Rican Winter League and stuff like that. But do you want a manager here with the Red Sox, probably the most scrutinized job in Major League Baseball, who has never managed in Major League Baseball before?
And Alex really only has 1 year of Major League coaching experience. So in that sense, it would be a risk, because until someone goes through that long grind of managing a team and preparing a team in spring training, you don't really know how they're going to react, how they'll handle that job. I would think if they were to hire Alex Cora, the Red Sox and Cora would be in agreement that they would need to get a veteran bench coach, somebody who's either been a major league manager before or who's been a coach for a long time. So how he would construct the coaching staff, I think, would go a long way in terms of maybe patching over the things that he doesn't know, while at the same time allowing him to use his personality and influence the team.
Let's go to the next candidate, which would be former Detroit Tigers manager Brad Ausmus. He's someone that Dave Dombrowski has hired before. He hired him as the manager of the Tigers. Ausmus was fired this year, obviously. There's familiarity there, which is good. Also, Ausmus has managed David Price. He managed David Price when Price pitched for the Tigers. Ausmus's record, though, with the Tigers wasn't great, and at times he had run-ins with the Detroit media, which is nothing like the ravenous Boston media. How realistic do you think Ausmus is as a candidate here?
Well, to me, he strikes me as a candidate that Dave Dombrowski was obviously comfortable with, having worked with him for more or less 2 years in Detroit, and that he was somebody that they wanted to bring in maybe perhaps if they didn't feel comfortable, say, with Alex Cora or another candidate. Dombrowski knows that he can work with Osmus. Osmus is a smart guy with a number of New England connections, grew up a Red Sox fan in Connecticut, attended Dartmouth, still has a home in Cape Cod. Longtime player, a very respected player in terms of building clubhouse chemistry in places like Houston and with the Dodgers. So if you were to hire Brad Osmus, it wouldn't be the most exciting pick. To me, he's more of a attractive second candidate if something were to, you know, Alex Cora could decide he wants to go manage somewhere else. And if that were to happen, I think Osmus is somebody Dave Dombrowski would be very comfortable in hiring.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see with Osmus. All right, the third candidate we know who has been interviewed for this job, Pete, is Ron Gardenhier. And he's the former manager of the Minnesota Twins. He did that for 13 seasons. He made the playoffs 6 times. He's been out of baseball, though, since 2014 as a manager. He is currently the bench coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks, whose manager is Troy Lovello. That's a familiar name to Red Sox fans because he was here as a bench coach for John Farrell. Now, Gardenhier's a little bit on the older side, and one of the issues that people have talked about with the Red Sox and John Farrell was that maybe he didn't relate to the team's young core, Andrew Benintendi, Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, Jackie Bradley Jr., as well as they had hoped. So why would an older manager like Gardenhier be able to relate to those guys when Farrell couldn't?
Well, what's interesting about Gardenhier, who's going to turn 60 next week, in Minnesota, a team with a low payroll, he had constant young players on his roster throughout the years that he was there, and he did that quite well. He was a very successful manager, led them to the playoffs, won a playoff series with them, all things in Minnesota that are difficult to do given their payroll constrictions. So I've been around him a lot because the Twins face the Red Sox 7 or 8 times every year in spring training in Fort Myers. So we see the Twins, and we saw Ron Gardenhier quite a bit. They were a team that played fundamentally well. They played hard. To me, I think he'd be a good fit. Gardenhier is a guy who could come in here and I think and change the clubhouse and at the same time keep the team on a track where they'd always be in contention for a playoff spot.
So, Pete, ultimately, who do you think is the next manager of the Boston Red Sox?
Well, I think it's Cora, unless the Red Sox put demands on him in accepting the job that he doesn't feel are acceptable. Cora is a smart guy. He's been around Fenway. He'll know the things he needs. And if he can come to an agreement with Dave Dombrowski, I would think he'd be the guy. He'd be the manager.
And I think the fact that they haven't made a choice or haven't made a hire at this point indicates that he would be the guy because he's still working. You know, the Astros are still in the playoffs. And these other people are people that could be hired tomorrow. And they could show up for a press conference. So I sort of agree that Cora looks like the guy that they've zeroed in on. Let's move off the managerial search here. I want to ask you about some offseason news. 2 Red Sox players underwent surgery this week. One of them, first baseman DH Hanley Ramirez, for what was a bulky shoulder, something that was bothering him as far back as spring training. And then pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez had surgery for that knee subluxation that he suffered in June in the bullpen in Baltimore. We know about those surgeries, and we know about the timetables. The Red Sox have said Hanley Ramirez should be ready for the start of the 2018 season. Eduardo Rodriguez, they've indicated, you know, that won't be the case, that he's going to return to pitching, but by the time he returns, he probably won't be ready for the start of the season. I want to ask you about Dustin Pedroia. Dave Dombrowski sort of dropped a bomb on all of us on trade deadline day when he said this is a chronic knee issue that Dustin Pedroia is going to have to deal with for the rest of his career. As far as you know, is Pedroia going to get surgery to repair that knee this offseason? And if so, how long would he be out?
Dustin has seen at least 2 specialists and probably more, and that right now he's sitting down with his agents, with his family, and trying to figure out what the best course of action is. And one potential course of action would be to have surgery. And if he did do that, it would be sort of that microfracture kind of surgery that a lot of NBA players end up getting. It's a risk. It's not the kind of surgery that necessarily always works. It's to a point now where it usually does. But it would also keep him out for a large chunk of the 2018 season. And the thing that they're trying to weigh is that the best thing to do and then to come back for the final 3 years of his contract as healthy as he can be? Or is the best thing to do to try to manage the pain, to get maybe more frequent days off, which was something that was going to happen anyway as he gets older, and try to get through it as best he can? I expect we're going to hear early next week, and it sounds to me, in talking to different people, that surgery is a very, very much a possibility because this knee issue is not something that, you know, arthroscopic procedure and a lot of rest and rehab is going to take care of.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not just going to go away. So that's some big news. I mean, the fact that we're talking about Dustin Pedroia and microfracture knee surgery, which is pretty serious. And as you mentioned, is something where it doesn't always take, or sometimes the recovery time is longer. Imagine the Red Sox going into 2018 without Dustin Pedroia. That would be yet another change, along with the new manager for the Red Sox. All right, Pete, thank you very much for joining us on Season Ticket. Great stuff, as always. You can follow Pete Abraham on Twitter. He's at Pete Abe. Pete, thanks.
All right, Chris, thank you.
All right, ahead, a special report from the team at Only a Game. The NCAA's troubled relationship with student athletes. You're going to want to hear this. That's up next. Welcome back. A quick note, if you like Season Ticket, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, or if you have an Android phone, you can check us out on Stitcher or Google Play. Subscribing is the best way to make sure you get the latest episode as soon as it's available. All right, let's talk about the world of amateur sports, or at least what people consider amateur sports. In September, the FBI arrested 10 people, including four assistant basketball coaches at prominent programs, as part of a probe exposing corruption in college basketball. The FBI alleges that the coaches accepted money to steer players to financial advisors, shoe companies, and sports agents. The FBI investigation also determined that at the behest of a coach, the athletic apparel company Adidas funneled $100,000 in cash to a player to convince him to commit to Louisville, which is an Adidas-wearing school. After that school was implicated in this FBI investigation, Louisville terminated its men's basketball coach, Rick Pitino. The team at WBUR and NPR's Only a Game conducted an extensive investigation into the NCAA's practices, culminating in an entire show dedicated to this one topic. The show was called Power, Money, and Corruption, The Story of the NCAA. Joining us now from Only a Game are senior producer Karen Given and producer Martin Kessler. They both worked on this report. Karen and Martin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
So when you guys decided to do this report, what was sort of the driving idea behind it? Because the idea of amateurism in the NCAA is something that is considered sacred, not only by the colleges and the NCAA, but really by the fans and the people who watch these sporting events.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we first started, we wanted to look at why so many people, and especially sort of experts on this topic, were saying players should be paid, and also why so many fans think they shouldn't. I mean, two out of every three fans, according to some surveys, say that college athletes, even at the very top level, shouldn't be paid. But then when you talk to analysts, when you talk to people who cover the topic, when you talk to athletes, they all say, no, those people should be paid. And we were like, where does that big division come from? Where does that difference in opinion come from?
So I'm a big college sports fan, and I'm a big college football fan. And I've always sort of looked at college sports and felt that you have to hold your nose a little bit. There is this willful suspension of disbelief, the idea that what you're seeing out there is pure and untainted, and that these are really student athletes. The euphemism that the NCAA coined for these college athletes who are making money for these colleges. Why do you think people are willing to sort of submit to this myth?
Well, I think it's partially that they're not willing to submit to the myth, but I think it's also that they're just uninformed. And what I mean by that is I think a lot of people don't really understand or try to understand the NCAA business model. And I think when you sort of put it to them in other terms, they start to see it. For example, if we were to say, hey, let's imagine there's this really great computer programmer. She's a young woman, and you know, Apple and Microsoft try and bid for her talents. And one, you know, Apple offers her $120,000 a year. Microsoft offers her $125,000 a year. But now let's say Apple, Microsoft, and Google all get together and say, you know what? Hey, let's only pay programmers $60,000 a year. That way we can keep our labor costs down. I think most Americans, when they hear that, would say, hey, you know, that's pretty messed up. And if they studied economics, I think they'd say that's kind of how a cartel works. But that's effectively how college sports operate. They basically say, you know, we're going to limit compensation to an athletic scholarship, which is about $60,000 a year maximum. And, you know, nowadays their value is just going up. College sports bring in about $10 billion a year.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is a big business. And you look at the television contracts that are generated from this, the revenue generated by schools like Ohio State and Texas make big, big money from this. And that money is not going to the players. That money is going to coaches and to athletic directors. In fact, in the Louisville case that we mentioned, where the FBI implicated Louisville, there was a report in the Louisville Courier-Journal that Louisville's contract with Adidas, which paid about $39 million, 98% of that money was being funneled to Rick Pitino, the coach.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the guys I spoke to for this story is former Wisconsin star Nigel Hayes. You know, he was one of the best players on Wisconsin, one of the best players in the country. And Wisconsin's basketball program was bringing in about $10 million in profit a year. Now, when Nigel was a freshman, he couldn't even afford a plane ticket home to go home for Thanksgiving. So I think when you start to, you know, look at that, I think people start to see, you know, this system maybe isn't so fair.
Yeah, that's a great point, Martin. And when you mentioned before, if people look at it simply in economic terms, it would seem that there's sort of collusion among the colleges to keep these costs at what they are, which are just the scholarships. But a lot of people will say, you know what, college is really expensive, and there are a lot of families that are struggling to pay for college. These athletes should be grateful that they're getting this free ride, this free scholarship, and then they can choose any education that they want. But that's not really the case, is it?
No, I mean, it's not. You're assuming that they can say Nigel Hayes could have gone in and said, I want to be a biology major. But he couldn't have because the coaches would have said, well, biology has labs and at lab time, you're supposed to be at practice. And so we can say, no, you can't. And so it really goes to this idea of the student athlete. The NCAA wants you to think that they are students first and athletes second. But that's just not the reality in these big time programs.
And Nigel Hayes, the former Wisconsin basketball star, even while he was still at Wisconsin, he was sort of aware of the ridiculousness of this term.
It's even funnier when you get to NCAA tournament. The guys always try to emphasize it. Hey, do you have any questions for the student athletes? And then it's like, dude, stop. You know we're not student athletes. Like, how am I a student athlete? And I've been gone since Tuesday. I don't play till Friday. And I just left school for a week.
So where did this construct come from, guys? This construct of the student athlete? I think most people just take it now, as I said, as the gospel, but it had to start somewhere.
It did start somewhere. And it starts in a really, really actually dark, scary place. So it was 1955, and there's a player for Fort Lewis A&M. His name was Ray Dennison, and he was a veteran, he was a father, he was a husband, and he was also a football player. And in the opening game of Fort Lewis A&M's season, his skull was crushed, basically. His skull was fractured on the top, crushed near the base of the spine. He died 30 hours later, and his widow said, you know what, my husband was going to school as a football player. He was on a football scholarship. He was injured while playing football. I should be able to get workers' comp benefits for my husband who died on the field. And Walter Byers, who was the executive director of the NCAA for more than three decades, he was pretty new on the job back then, he met with his legal department and said, this won't work. Like, the entire system will shut down if people start thinking of athletes as workers. So they came up with this term student athlete, and they told all the schools, call your players student athletes, call your teams, not clubs, because the pros used the term clubs, and put this amateurism pledge in every scholarship offer. And that worked. Dennison's widow lost her suit, and the phrase stuck, and everybody uses it. And they don't think about where it came from.
No, they really do not. And I'll tell you, I've covered the NCAA men's basketball tournament, and also I've covered the college football national championship game. And they ask you as a media member to refer to the players as student athletes. It's something that they really, really stress. So this is a big part sort of NCAA canon. And you mentioned, Karen, it came from Walter Byers, but he had a different take on the system he helped create.
Yeah. Eventually he did. So he took over the NCAA when he was just 29 years old. He was the first executive director. Before that, the organization was really just a debating society. It had no enforcement power whatsoever. So he created the enforcement division. He really sort of turned the NCAA basketball tournament into March Madness. It was just a tiny little thing before he got involved. He coined the phrase student athlete as we said. He signed all of these increasingly lucrative television contracts that just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then towards the very end of his career, after about 35 years of doing this, he changed his mind. And he said, you know what? This is wrong. There's all this money coming in, and we need to be sharing that with the workers, with the people. I mean, he at that point decided they are workers and they are doing something that is bringing in revenue.
And there's also a racial component to this,
sure,
because at the higher levels, Division One, a lot of the players are African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an element here of, is there undue control? There are some people who feel that this in some way echoes slavery, that there's sort of a plantation mentality to college sports.
Yeah, Walter Byers himself said that. So Walter Byers was a very private man. He didn't talk in public very often at all, but we were able to find this recording of him saying exactly what you just mentioned, that there's a plantation mentality in the NCAA.
And it's a disservice to these young people that the management of intercollegiate athletics stays in place, committed to an outmoded code of amateurism. And I attribute that to, quite frankly, to the neo-plantation mentality that exists on the campuses of our country and in the conference offices and in the NCAA.
Just looking at the numbers, this is from 2014-15. In the top conferences, 56.3% of college football players were black, and 60.8% of men's college basketball players are black. And I think this sort of speaks to, you know, why Karen and I and Shira Springer were so, you know, interested in delving into this topic, because, you know, at first you could say, is this really an issue that just affects the top 5% of college athletes? You know, in the grand scheme of things, that's not that many people who are being hurt. But when you look at those numbers, you start to see that this is really a question about who our society values and who our society decides to treat fairly. And the Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone, we spoke to him, and here's Kevin talking about that issue.
This is an issue that affects black families more directly than anyone. And so when we see black families putting so much emphasis on the athletic development of their children, particularly black males, because they are lured by the athletic system at a very young age, it's a big, big problem.
And that's an issue that affects not just the top 5% of college athletes, but it's something that affects every American.
Yeah, that's a good point, Martin. I think a lot of people have a vested interest in keeping this system in place. And it's not just the colleges. I think, mm-hmm, if you look at the National Football League and the National Basketball Association, these colleges essentially are free farm systems, free minor leagues for them. The NBA does have a minor league. It's called the G League. But it's not nearly as attractive to the best potential NBA players, the best high school kids, as playing major college basketball is and playing the NCAA tournament. And obviously the NBA has a rule where you have to have a full year out of high school before you're even eligible for the draft. So I think it's not just the colleges that are complicit in this system. I think it's the fans who have that willful suspension of disbelief, but also the NFL and the NBA who, you know, if suddenly you had to have some other minor league system where you had to pay these guys, that would cut into their profits.
Absolutely. And, you know, Adam Silver has talked about getting rid of that rule. But unless he provides some other alternative for players who aren't quite ready for the pros, but are still eventually going to be pro players, it's not enough. And the NFL is far worse because, of course, they say players have to be 3 years out of high school. And they don't really provide any alternative for players to make their way to the NFL without going to college. And this is not only, we have been talking about how the universities take advantage of the players, but this is really how those two leagues that make ridiculous amounts of money are taking advantage of the universities, because universities are supposed to be about education. They're not supposed to be minor league systems for pro sports.
Right. And can I just say that, you know, I think growing up in the U.S., we just sort of get used to this, but this is not how other countries do it. You know, other countries do not tie minor league sports to their universities. That's an American tradition, and you know, Karen can sort of speak to the origins of how that got intertwined.
Oh, it's a crazy story with Teddy Roosevelt and muscular Christianity, and probably more than we have time to go into today.
Yeah, probably. But it is a great point, Martin, though. It is a uniquely American idea and ideal to tie those things together, getting an education and looking at major sports and preparing people to play professionally. Thank you guys so much for joining us. A great discussion on college sports and where it stands in our society. That's Karen Given and Martin Kessler from Only a Game. Thanks, guys, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Finally, the cheap seats. Former Patriots defensive end Chris Long is an example of why asking athletes to just stick to sports is short-sighted. One of the league's most socially conscious players, Long was the first high-profile white NFL player to express support for the Anthem protest against social injustice. He also has a charity dedicated to providing clean drinking water to East Africa. On Wednesday, Long announced that he's donating his entire $1 million base salary this season to charity. Long now plays for the Philadelphia Eagles, and he's pledged his final 10 game checks to organizations dedicated to wiping out educational inequality. One of those organizations, SummerSearch, operates here in Boston. Long had already pledged his first 6 game checks of the season to providing scholarships for students in his hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. He did that following the clash between white nationalists and counter-protesters there in August. Being a professional athlete and an activist are not mutually exclusive. We should welcome the fact that Long is interested in tackling social issues and not just quarterbacks. And that's it for this edition of Season Ticket. If you liked us, be sure to tell a friend. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. For more great sports stories, subscribe to the Boston Globe. Season Ticket is a production of the WBUR iLab and the Boston Globe. I'm Chris Gasper. We'll see you tomorrow.